hosts Maya Monell and Aaron Papworth, founders of the Navit Money app, the money management app that uses behavioral science to foster financial wellness. This week, we've sat down with Dr. Sebastian Deotrio, a professor of economic policy at the University of Virginia. Sebastian's work focuses on understanding how policies affect individuals' health, behaviors, and economic outcomes. In this episode, we explore how our health and our economy are impacted by a loss of healthcare coverage and what we can do to overcome these barriers, especially as we enter into a post-COVID world. Welcome back to another episode of the Navit podcast. Sebastian, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you joining us today. Why don't we kick it off and let you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Everyone, my name is Sebastian Deotrio. I'm a professor of econ and public policy at the University of Virginia. I am born and raised in Lima, so I'm actually an immigrant, but I've been living here for a while. And for the past few years, I've been doing research on the topics of health insurance, mental health, and quite recently, HIV.
We are so excited to sit down with you today, Sebastian. I think that there's a lot of hot budding topics that our listeners are keen to hear your thoughts on. And really what I'd love to learn a little bit more about, or hear rather, a little bit more about before we dive in is kind of where your research has taken you. You're at UVA right now. What, in a post-COVID or current COVID society, what are you most focused on right now?
Yeah, great question. So I think from the beginning of my grad school career, been interested in health economics. And that comes from, there's kind of like several stories, but I think one that is kind of like the origin story is, being at home in Peru and growing up, there was this story in the news of an old man dying while he was waiting in line to get care at the hospital. And that at a very young age was such a like baffling thing to me. And I'm like, oh, like there's no hope. Like this guy was already in the hospital and he was just waiting to get care and the system failed him in that manner. And I think that got me like super interested in that social problem of health. And so I started, a lot of my early work is on like understanding health insurance and understanding, how different designs of health insurance affects people's decisions of like which insurance to take. Then I move on into really looking at understanding what happens when people lose health insurance, specifically what happens when they lose Medicaid. And what's interesting about that, is that in economics, at least, we had a lot of research on what happens when you gain Medicaid and how your certain outcomes improve. But we didn't have too much evidence of what happens when you lose. We just thought it was just the opposite, which could be true, could not be true. Maybe there's other ways that people mitigate, you know, not having insurance. And so I was kind of like pushing a little bit on that frontier and understanding that, and spoiler alert, chances are that it's not great. And you know, there's certain people that like do have the, let's say, resources or network to find themselves in a position that they're okay, but there are some other people who are not, right? Think of people with chronic conditions, if you get into a car accident, and that's going to be a huge financial shock to your system. Maybe you don't have any like, you know, savings, or even if you have some savings, that could all go away really quickly. And so in that sense, it's a big deal. And now I'm moving more towards this topic of mental health, and in broad sense, is from the econ point of view, is how does economic factors like your job, having health insurance, any of this stuff affect your mental health? And then the other question, which is how does your mental health affect these economic outcomes? And so, I mean, I think now and more days we're paying more attention to mental health, but even on your regular conversations that you may have with a person, we don't internalize, like we internalize the flu very different from like, I'm having anxiety. And so like, if I tell you like, hey, I'm feeling underwater, I have the flu, people are like, oh, I hope you feel better. It's like, versus like, oh yeah, I'm feeling anxiety. People are like, oh, well, what caused it, right? We always need a trigger. We don't understand it as a physical disease in some ways. We understand it as like, you must be let down because you read something bad on Facebook, right? And so it's that kind of narrative that is interesting. But nevertheless, so mental health is health, is physical health at the end of the day too, and it has an effect on economic outcomes that people have and the family have. And so the new research that I'm coming up is investigating where in all those places do we see it, and if we can do anything to mitigate it from the policy point of view, from the government point of view, from the private sector point of view, like what are things that we can do to improve people's mental health? So that's, summary for that.
No, I love it because, you know, especially as we're talking in times of COVID, it's easier, I think, for a broad population and our communities to make the correlation between the flu or between bouts of illness and pandemic to mental illness as well. Like if you begin to categorize mental illness as just another another illness, then we understand the ramifications, we understand the global impact of really a global health crisis, which is rising levels of anxiety and stress, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And suicide as well. Yeah, and depression. Exactly. No, it's absolutely,
And I think it's one of those things like, you know, maybe we saw that early on with COVID of like, if you didn't experience it yourself, then you're skeptical as to understand the ramifications or the effects of it. And I think we see the same thing with depression and anxiety. If you don't have somebody you live with or you yourself have not experienced those symptoms, it's very easy to brush it off if you don't know much about it.
Absolutely.
So can't wait to dive into these topics. So let's start off as we're talking and kind of have a focus on healthcare today and the expense of healthcare and how it does impact your mental health. Let's kick things off with, you know, what happens when you do lose that coverage? What are people facing? And can you walk us through that and how to kind of take hold of that?
Yeah, for sure. And just so we're all on the same page, I'll definitely be talking in the US context as opposed to a world vision of health insurance, because that's also a different topic.
And that's a whole podcast, I think. Yeah. A whole other series. Yeah.
Yeah. So right now in kind of like 2020 state, if you lose health insurance and you probably, a lot of people are facing this because a lot of people have employer-sponsored insurance. Because of COVID, a lot of people are losing their employment and therefore they're losing insurance. So you may find yourself in this situation. What are the things you have available for? So there are kind of like overall six main options, I would say. Some may be available to everyone depending on where you live and your age. So let's start with option number one is as simple as going into your partner's health insurance plan. And it's likely that you probably have already done that if you lost health insurance and your partner has health insurance plan that they can add to you. But if the employer of your partner provides it, then that's one way. Two, the dependent coverage. So this is if you're under 26 and your parents have health insurance through their employer, then that health insurance may be able to cover you as well, obviously for paying a fee. But that's only if you're under 26. There are some states in which that age threshold is higher, and so you may want to check that depending on the state where you live. The third option is probably the most common one. It's to buy health insurance in the marketplace, right? This is just your regular, you go and find a plan that fits you well. Pay attention that given your income, you may be eligible for subsidies for paying those premiums and some costs of obtaining the health insurance. And some people, I think I like to say here that some people think that like, well, I earned a lot last year, so I'm not qualified for a subsidy. If you just lost your employment, that means your income has gone in theory to zero. So you actually could qualify for a subsidy. So you may want to pay attention to that. Fourth option is Medicaid. So if you're in a state where Medicaid has been expanded, then you are likely to be eligible, especially if you came from the I lost my job route, because that means, again, so your income has maybe potentially gone to zero or to very small and you qualified. And so it's always good to check and there's most states have like a website where you can kind of like quickly check some eligibility. But if not, they have like social workers that either chat or through call, they can work with that. Fifth option is to think of COBRA. So this is basically a program designed to fill the gaps between the times and periods where you don't have health insurance And so it's kind of thought in the way of like, oh, let's say I finish school in May and I'm starting my job in September. So between those months, I'm uninsured, and COBRA, it's something that can fill that kind of like gap. If you just now lost your employment, that's another way to obtain it. Now, COBRA is not free. What it is you jump into your employer's health insurance plan, but you pay for it kind of like fully. So you may say like, well, why would I do that? Might as well go to buy private health insurance. And the reason why you may want to do that is because if you were in a plan where you already paid a lot of your deductible, let's say you had a $2,000 deductible and you paid like $1,900, so you're only like $100 left. Mm-hmm. Then if you jump to a new insurance plan, you need to pay the new insurance, but also pay the full deductible in order to get your insurance kicked in. So those are the decisions where you may want to consider remaining in your health insurance plan, even though it's more expensive, because you're close to your insurance kicking in versus restarting a whole new plan. So that really depends on like what kind of plan, how much it costs, and that kind of conversation. But it's an option, you know, for certain people who may be that good option. And the sixth and last option, this is something that I think people forget sometimes, but it's good. It's not great, but most places have access to free healthcare clinics where you can get a lot of your primary care done for free or very, very low cost. These are good clinics. Just because they're free doesn't mean they're bad clinics. Usually they're attached to a university or provided from a university. They obviously, you cannot get all your services there, but a lot of kind of like the primary care triage would be able to get there. So that's another option if you find yourself uninsured and you want to take care of something that hopefully is not major. So this would be the six options. Yeah.
No, I think that's great and beautifully laid out. So thank you for going through those. A lot of our audience skews a little bit younger. And I think that mm-hmm. there is, again, like you said, in the US, there's kind of this stigma or stereotype that young people don't need coverage. Mm. I want to ask you that question, this next question with that in mind. How can what would you say to that, certainly? And then how can those people, based on your advice, evaluate their options? What should they look for if they really are a kind of low cost employee, right? Or a member of the workforce?
Yeah. So I think young adults, and it's definitely a population that they're the hardest to get insured, for lack of a better word. And yeah. And for good reason, right? If you're a young person and you're doing the math, is like, well, if I've never have gone to the hospital last year, if I get health insurance, I'm spending overall in a year, let's say, I don't know, $2,000 to $5,000 for getting no benefit, right? Because I'm never going to the doctor, right, or whatever. Then why would I do that? Or maybe I am going to the doctor, but I can spend like $300 without insurance. So right. that math makes sense. And that's why a lot of people maybe choose not to. And at the end of the day, and the way we economists think about this is like, everyone is thinking about their risk of like the risk of having an event happening. Mm-hmm. And I think I encourage young people there to think about a couple of things. One is, well, A, do you have any chronic conditions? Just because you're young and healthy, that's great. But maybe you do have some chronic conditions and you need some pills or some, you know, access to certain medication or procedure. So that's one. Two, think about your potential cushion or network. Like if a bad event happens and you need to spend, let's say, $5,000, $7,000, mm-hmm. can you do that? This is very similar to thinking about, should I get car insurance, which is mandated. You have to get car insurance, right? But like, and you can get a little bit of pluses here and there, but like the way we think about car insurance is it's not like you do it because you think you're never going to have a car accident. You do it in case you have a car accident, right? To mitigate that financial shock. So it is an expensive price to pay because certain, you know, plans are expensive, mm-hmm. but it is how risky you want to be if a financial shock comes to you and you don't have that protection.
Sure.
In terms of plans, what that means usually for the people who are like consider themselves like healthier is that you may want to look at the plans that are low premium, high deductible. And so that means that your every premium is what you pay every month. So like the plan cost, those should be relatively low, but your deductible, which is how much you need to pay before your insurance kicks in, it's going to be high. And so the way those plans work is, okay, I'm not paying quote unquote that much every month. And if something happens, let's say, you know, a $5,000, you know, emergency department kind of visit, then, okay, I can afford a $2,000, which is a deductible, and then my insurance will kick in and I pay like part of that. And so those are the plans that people tend to gravitate to when you're a young adult, rather than the plans where you're paying a lot in premiums, right? You're paying maybe $300 or $2,000 in premiums and you almost have zero deductible. But if you're not going to use that much care, then you're just putting $2,000, right, on a plan that doesn't give you a deductible, but like you're never going to use that. So usually that's why young people gravitate to the high deductible or premium plans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would be curious too, and I'm going to sidebar us here, but what's the impact on the economy on the U.S. economy for, I would assume, that younger workforce not getting covered compared to, say, a universal healthcare plan in another country? I mean, do we see significant impact year over year?
Well, actually, do we see what percentage of that population isn't insured? Like, is it a significant portion?
In the United States?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in the United States, I believe our uninsurance rate were about 14%. So I don't remember the math conditional and being young age, like what is the share of those? But I imagine most of those people are coming from that 14% there.
And that's really changed since the Affordable Care Act, right? That's
right
in the last 10 years, yeah.
Yeah. So the three things that the Affordable Care Act did that tackled that population is, one, it says individual mandate, everyone needs to have insurance, otherwise you pay the penalty. Mm-hmm. Two is the Medicaid expansion, which a lot of then childless adults, which usually, you know, people in that age range can be eligible for Medicaid. And then three is the dependent coverage mandate, which is up to the age of 26. And then again, some states have it on different ages. But but those are the three things that kind of like made those people like have health insurance. And this is like what I think that's also important to remind ourselves is that around 60% of people in the United States have health insurance through their employer. So we're the majority of people have insurance through their employer, and then the ones that don't, they have these other options, and then you have the what's left, which is the uninsured.
Yeah. So my little MPH was done prior to the Affordable Care Act coming in, or it was like just around, I guess. He was elected when I was doing it. So very shortly thereafter. But at the time when we were studying health economics, it was the incredible burden of uninsured people's healthcare costs was reallocated to the insurance companies and to the people that were insured. So our premiums were going high. And I think that was part of the argument. You know, this is half the argument, right? Our insurance premiums kept going higher and higher because, you know, you can't deny care in this country, which I'm very glad for. I think that absolutely is an ethical question that no one should be denied care. But at the same time, someone has to pay for it. And our system is incredibly bloated. I love systems. So I want to ask you about that in a second. But I don't know what's happened since then. That was 10 years ago, you know. So now with the Affordable Care Act and with a significantly smaller population uninsured, is it still the same? Like, you know, they go in for care and the rest of us kind of have to pay through our networks, or how does that work? Yeah. I didn't mean to derail the question that Maya, I think it is an interesting question on what's the impact to the economy.
Right. The intuition is correct there. Like insurance, if you're thinking about it, you're starting your own insurance company. What you want is, you know, to everyone pay their fees, and the people who are paying subsidizes the people who are having the accidents or having the health costs. Right. And so the problem with young people not getting insurance is that if they're the young and the healthy, then the premiums for everyone else and the cost for everyone else was going to go up, because then I just need to fund everyone through the money that, let's say, the people who are using more of the service is having. Now, not the issue with that, but I think in parallel, we'll have to think about the following. They're like, okay, well, the ACA, you know, made people get health insurance, and that's great. But it's not like we saw premiums blasting down or healthcare costs blasting down. So that some people may be like, well, what happened? Well, there's, for anything that has a price in the world, there's a lot of different forces, and the other force is just competition, right? Mm-hmm. So in some places, if there's only one provider of health insurance available and they have no competition, then they can kind of like start pricing in however, not
technically that's a monopoly and it's not legal in this country. Okay, we'll keep going.
Well, there's some, yeah, there's some caveats to that. But in any case, the point being that like a lot of those things, other parts of the system that were embedded before the ACA and that the ACA did not address are still there. And therefore, you still have the situations where you have a lot of high prices for your costs and your care. And so bringing young to and healthy, more than young, is really healthy, the word there, to the system. I think it did affect in probably some places, but it's not this like wide shift in like lower premiums for everyone that maybe some people were expecting, just because that price tag was it's affected by also other stuff in the context there. It's just kind of like the short summary of that. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I think, I mean, that's one way it affects the economy. The other way it affects the economy is if you don't have insurance and you get injured and that's a financial shock to you and you cannot weather it, then you may have to file for bankruptcy, right? And bankruptcy is really hard to recover from. And so that's another impact there. If there's uncompensated care for certain hospitals, that means the hospitals are not receiving that money and maybe the hospital's not doing so great. That could be burdensome in the hospital. There's programs that give money to hospitals that have a share of compensated care that has not been paid. And there's more complications to that. But like I think overall, those are kind of like the mechanisms and ways in which that not having health insurance could affect different parts, you know, of the
economy. And I believe isn't medical bills the number one cause for bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy in America?
So,
wow, that's what I remember.
Let's say it differently. So I think people that have bankruptcies also may have high medical bills, but I would be cautious of using the causation path.
Okay.
So it's like, let me put it. So this is actually, there's a paper out there, I think by Elizabeth Warren and co-authors, and they kind of like try to tackle this. But so the way they did things was, I'm like simplifying it to make a point, was something along the lines of conditional on having a bankruptcy, how many of those people have like high medical bills. And that's similar to me going to like asking a bunch of big tech CEOs, what's the common thing? And they say, I dropped out of college. And then you say, dropping out of college makes you a big CEO. So in that sense, we want to ask, out of the people who have medical bills, which ones are, you know, have it, there's a likelihood of you having a bankruptcy, and the people who don't have, which is like having a bankruptcy in order to have that causal framework. But nevertheless, point is that if you have a lot of like bills that you can't pay, would you go to bankrupt? Yeah, you probably would go bankrupt. Like, so there is some causation there, but the broader statement, I would have to read a little bit more to get myself more convinced.
Okay, so in the headline, it's a good headline for us to all read on. And I think that then gets me into a question that comes up, and certainly around your research too, is like, how is, you spoke a little bit in the beginning about the mental health effects of the stress of losing care.
Yeah.
And coverage, maybe to Aaron's point too, we certainly see that around financial stress and the mental and frankly physical impacts of that level of stress. I imagine financial stress and stress of losing coverage is probably in the same wheelhouse of mental impact and maybe long-term illness.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's funny, when I was thinking about the last question about bankruptcy, I should have talked about what I know from my own research, which is, long story short, when you lose Medicaid, the likelihood of going bankrupt goes up. And by likelihood, I mean like there's certain people who did go bankrupt. Bankruptcy also, it's like a very extreme outcome. So even though, yeah, that's true, it doesn't happen to a lot of people. But what does happen is you have huge accumulation in debt that is what is called severely delinquent, which means 90 days past due. So like, long story short, we do know that when you lose health insurance, there's huge financial repercussions that I would say even take you to have bankruptcies, which I think is like the primary point. So more than like, you know, are bankruptcies all caused by medical bills as well? Well, not having insurance, which means not being able to pay your bills, does cause you to go to bankruptcy in that way.
Right.
In the same way, if you get Medicaid, you less likely to have those debt and bankruptcy. Now, to get it to the point of mental health, So this is actually somewhat recent in making those connections. But the evidence that we have does suggest that basically having insurance, health insurance specifically, does alleviate or improve your mental health through that security of, okay, I have something to fall under if something happens. Mm-hmm. And when you lose it, the evidence is a little bit more, I would say, murkier and not like crystal clear. And I do have some work on this. And I was surprised by this, that it's not super immediate and obvious that you see a decrease in mental health. And that could just very well be because the way we're measuring mental health, at a population level it's not easy because it's, you know, at best we have some surveys that a lot of people answer of like, how are you feeling? They're very subjective. And in other cases, we have things like hospitalization with diagnoses, but those things don't happen so often. So it's a little bit, hard to identify an effect there. But at least I think from the broad evidence from a lot of different studies, it's clear that, you know, losing and also having health insurance are both good and bad, depending on which margin you are. I think that the most clear evidence was from this Oregon health insurance experiment, in which people got health insurance, Medicaid specifically. They did not see improvements in physical health, like cholesterol tests and blood tests and stuff like that, but they did see improvements in mental health. And so that tells you that there is just kind of like an explicit financial aspect of health insurance that affects your mental health, rather than like, I'm improving my health, therefore I'm improving my mental health, my physical health, and therefore I'm improving my health. There is like that just state of security, or at least indication of that, which I think it sounds very intuitive, hopefully, to most people that like,
Well, it could have an impact. I mean, if you look long term, right, the less chronic stress you have in your life, maybe the less likely down the road you are to develop chronic physical illness like diabetes, hypertension, anything that's related.
Absolutely.
Correlated to the kind of mental considerations that we're talking about.
Yeah. And there's also, like, by the way, there's also, we always talk about like the direct effect, but with some colleagues, we're working in a paper where we are seeing how does opportunities in which your kids get health insurance, how does that affect your parents' mental health? And there's also that mechanism too of like, when maybe other people or people that you care for get health insurance when they didn't have it, then you're actually also mental health better off, even though that's not affecting your physical health directly, right? Because you're not getting insurance. If somebody else is getting insurance, and that also affects your mental health too. So
interesting.
Just on a side note on the mental health question, so are people trying, because mental health, I'm curious, you know, it really sounds like it's only been the last, let's say, I don't know, you tell me, 10 years, mental health has been really become kind of in the fore of academic research. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
I think in the quantity sense, I think there are some people that have been studying this for maybe 20 years, but like, I think in the more catching fire, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so are people working on different rubrics and matrix that they can measure it by? Because that's really interesting to me that you can't, it's really hard to identify.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no. So that's a great question. So it's actually, maybe I misspoke. So we do have a number of like tests and questions that we can ask people in order to know their mental health conditions. That's kind of like the psychiatry of things, right? So there's some people who can figure out diagnoses. The problem is that we don't do those in a wide population wide. It's not like we ask everyone in the state. So there are a few surveys out there in which they have a subset of those questions, but it's not like this widely available relative to, let's say, questions where they ask you about physical health.
Right.
So I think it's about, we do know how to do the measurement, we just don't ask them widely.
It means that correlations are not easy, or causation, like you were talking about before, are not easily identified of like, okay, you're in a stress, you have stress in your life and chronic stress. Like there is data that shows then like what physical ailments kind of come of that to some degree, although every person is different, right? There have been tests like that.
Yeah. So mental health affects your physical health for sure. Like if you have anxiety, right, you're going to have tightness on your chest, hardness to breathe. So those, I would say that's kind of like the medical part of mental health, of like studying the relationship between that and physical health and the elements and all of that stuff for sure. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, but also then like things in your life, like are you more likely to lose your job? Are you more likely to have a lower, production? Are you, things? Are you divorced, like personal life stuff?
Yeah. So I think that's the part of research that I've seen. Let's say like we kind of know from like somewhat narrow experiments, a small sample size, or like things that like make sense that they affect other parts of your life. Because when, people are depressed, we know that they don't perform so well in their jobs and stuff like that. But we haven't seen, I think, a lot of that in the broad population kind of way. So in some ways, we know that from the individual level, kind of like mechanism stories, but we don't have like those aggregate numbers of like, well, does that mean that like for every third of people that have like, let's say, depression, what is that dollar, let's say, value and less productivity, right? Those kinds of estimates, though, that's the thing that I think, or like what happens in marriage, or what happens in any other outcome that you think, educational outcomes, right? Not only, educational and marriage and economics and any other, outcomes that you can think about people. I think that the broad estimate part, that's a part of that I think we still need to do a lot more work on. And I think it's important because that's really what helps the policymaker know where to put their money, right? So like in some sense, it's like, yeah, we know that health insurance is bad, or we know that mental health is bad. But like the question is like, okay, how about it? Where's our best bang for our buck, right? That's kind of like where the discussion of why those numbers are important.
Mitigate the effects.
Yeah.
So you're on the cutting edge of mental health research. I'm
I'm trying to be before everyone catches on. No, I'm just kidding. No, everyone is welcome. Let's do more mental health research. It's exciting. Yeah.
No, I think it's really exciting. And certainly kind of bringing it back, I feel like a broken record these days on the post-COVID world, right, that we're hopefully entering into soon. How do you think health insurance, how the healthcare system in our country is going to be forced to change?
Or is it? Yeah. Or are we just going to?
Yeah.
Pessimist over here in my co-founder.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, go on.
Usually the pessimist, and I'm usually the optimist, but on this one, we're opposite.
I think the short answer is, I don't know. But the longer answer is, what we've seen from the past is that when there are major crises or things that happen, whether that's a country or locality, you do see reforms related to that. And that's very much the case for healthcare. When you think about the introduction of Medicaid and Medicare and Medicare Part D and state health and children's health insurance, like all of these come like as kind of like almost reactionary of like, this happened, therefore we do this. So, I mean, it seems ripe to do a healthcare reform just because people are going to be maybe really hungry for it, and policymakers are looking for new innovative ideas. And we kind of, a lot of people were excited about the Affordable Care Act, and they still are. But I think a lot of people maybe are dissatisfied with the results. And so, I think the hunger and the timing is ripe. Is it going to happen? I don't know. I mean, what's going to happen in November? Who knows? So I think I tend to shy away from making any predictions in that matter, because I truly don't know.
One thing I think is interesting to talk about just briefly on the system is that federal government policy versus state. And I think, it's so interesting in our country, you can have the Affordable Care Act at the federal level, but states our state rights are so strong that there is a lot of power at the state level to be able to dictate how it's implemented, where the money's allocated, you know, especially, mm-hmm. and I like talk about taking away, I hope we were recording when we were talking about that, but taking away rights, you know, the women's health rights and I mean, mm-hmm. our and other marginalized populations are always under attack. And that you've seen that in the like, state level of Texas, you know, that had horrible mm-hmm. maternal child outcomes after they defunded basically all of it so they could kind of go after abortion. And mm-hmm. so my point is, you know, there is some power of the individual in this country to vote locally at their state level for people that will at least try and implement the most effective healthcare policy on the state level, right? You can't really change. I mean, hopefully you can if you vote and you're in like those swing states.
Right.
I'm currently not, but you know, you can't really change that federal level as much as long as you're, you know, your representative. But I do think that's interesting.
But also in a more virtual setting, as we talk about the place of work in this conversation, I mean, you know, look at what's happening with tech employees, right? Like people are leaving their coastal cities and moving inland. So even if it is a state by state, yeah, we see state by state improvement in regulations. How does the employer effectively come into that conversation if they're in a state that doesn't have some level of universal coverage, for instance?
Yeah, I think Erin's point is first, right? It's like we do not need to wait for the federal government to get their act together in order to do healthcare reform. It can be done at the state and I know in the case of Virginia, that's what they're trying to do. I mean, the state Medicaid expansion is a clear example of that, right? There's still, mm-hmm. I think, 14 states that have not decided not to expand. Florida is one of them. And to your second point, Maya, which is also really true, is like, I mean, this is the beauty in the darkness of having the state system, right? Which is everyone can play by their own rules, but everyone can play by their own rules. And so it's like, that's a part of the problem, right? Like health insurance companies, you know, it's not like they can move left to right because every state has a different kind of set of regulations or anything to ask, and that makes it more complicated. And so it would be nice to have that federal kind of like, these are the laws for everyone and the law of the lands for everyone. So like, I think there's pros and cons within the health care conversation about that. And I think, I think there's two quotes that I think they're kind of like the opposite of each other, but I think it's always good to keep in mind, which is what I hear a lot in the healthcare discussion is, you know, perfect is the enemy of good, right? Which is like, well, we do want maybe Medicare for all, but like, let's try this more like utter less, maybe harsher or difficult political reforms because we're trying to just be better. And the other current narrative is like, well, incremental is the enemy of fundamental, right? Which means like, by focusing on those small marginal changes, you're not focusing on the core change.
Totally.
And so I think those are, to me, the two narratives that it's like, well, perfect is the enemy of good, and then incremental.
And then band-aids. Put band-aids on.
Oh, I've never heard that one. That's
really good.
That's an original. The two are not original, but the combination of those are original.
That's great. Okay, you should coin that. TM.
Yeah. Yeah.
It actually kind of leads, Maya, are you going to go to the universal? Because you're going there?
No, go for it.
Because I think we would be remiss, and this is a very hot political topic, and we're mm-hmm. getting late into the podcast, but we would be remiss to ask you, especially because our population is younger, this question about the universal coverage, like kind of, you know, the more like left Democrats that are talking about socialist or universal healthcare type systems versus moderate Democrats versus Republicans that have all these different proposals. But I would be interested. I think we just like one of the foundational issues is the state versus federal rights. And so that clarifies something. But what is your perspective? Like, is that single payer system ever going to be able to occur in the greater United States, or, you know, and where do you think that's going?
Yeah. Again, I think the short answer is I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in terms of American politics, if we're going to get there or not.
Please have a crystal ball and tell us.
Yeah. I think we're on the way there in the sense that everything that has been happening since the introduction, or not everything, but most of the major things that has been happening since the introduction of Medicaid and Medicare have been towards a path of universal coverage. And so, and you know, Medicaid and Medicaid was in the 60s or 2020s. It's been a while now. And so it's hard for me to think, that's why I think it's hard for me to think that it's going to happen super soon. But again, it's, we're in time of high uncertainty, and maybe there is the ripe moment, as I said, like a pandemic like this hasn't happened in years or decades, right? And so maybe it is going to become a topic of discussion. And so that's, I think that's point number one. So I think it's a maybe and it's going to happen. And at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of people still in the States that are real scared of that idea of universal medical coverage, because we've been told that it's going to cost a lot of money and all this other part. I like to talk about that narrative in a very, I guess, simple way. Or I mean, it's simple, even though it's abstracting from a lot of details that maybe are important. So the conversation about universal health coverage, from the, I would say, economist point of view, is about universal coverage gives you coverage for everyone. Great. Notice that doesn't guarantee you necessarily like access to a provider, right? Doesn't solve the rural issue of lack of providers, doesn't solve a lot of other healthcare issues. It does solve a number of them, but doesn't solve, let's say, all of them. And that's great. It also gives you a greater push towards equality and equity across, you know, many, many demographics and populations. So those are, I think, the good things. The cost, it's funny, like, it is gonna cost money, but like relative to what do we know from how it's working in other countries, like OECD countries and countries that have the system, that's not really, I would say, maybe my concern. The concern is really about the innovation part. And so in a very simple discussion, the problem is when you take away all that competition and all that system, do you see less innovation? Right. And I think some people will answer the question, yes, you do see less innovation. And then you're like, well, why do I care about innovation? And the reason why you care about innovation is the reason why you would care for a vaccine for COVID, because that could change the world. And so that's where it gets, I think, the important discussion is like, is the trade-off, I think, between the likelihood of innovate and doing massive changes into lack of mortality and health improvements. If you look at health improvements in the last 100 years, they're like about a pill, a procedure, right? And those are huge, right? It's a huge returns to that, yeah, versus a trade-off of like equity and like coverage. And that's just such a huge, like, hard conversation to have and weird conversation to have, because we're trading future. It's like, it's the counterfactual of like the life that we never know we saved versus the equity that we have now. That's, yeah, it's just that, that's where I think it gets like really weird to think about. And I think some people, when they think about it in that level, they're like, if, you know, in some sense, well, if we never get to know the counterfactual, then let's just have Medicare for all, right? Versus some people are like, yeah, but that policy could have been better. And I mean, that's where, you know, we get a discussion and people say like, well, why can't we have it all? Maybe we can create systems so we can have innovation and stuff like that. And sure, let's have that discussion. I think that's great. But I think in the very broad spectrum is a trade-off, right? It's right. This policy comes with a trade-off, and the trade-off is that innovation part and incentives to have innovations versus is like the coverage and equality and as a society, what do we value? How do we deal with that? That's what we have to answer.
God, that's so good.
You've given us a lot to think about today, Sebastian.
That's good. I'm going to get in trouble.
And, you know, we'll have you on here again so we can continue sure to contemplate the meaning of life and certainly how we can
right
make it better. But I want to conclude with our rapid fire money mantra round that we ask every guest.
Awesome.
So number one, what money stereotype have you had to relearn?
Yes. I think the one that it maybe, there's two that are a little bit recent, that I had to relearn. One is that debt is not necessarily a bad thing. I think, you know,
you bought a house.
What did you say?
Did you buy a house?
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like I bought a house, but more importantly, it's like, oh, I want to pay it as quickly as possible. I'm like, wait a minute. Actually, that's not necessarily the smartest thing to do. So, and but even and even conversations about national debt, right? Like there's scenarios like the national debt should be zero, and I'm like, why? That it could mean that we're underinvesting if it's zero, right? Maybe we should be invested more in lowering ourselves from the United States. And so, I think that's like something that when I talk to a lot of people, they're like, it's not like they realize, they're like, oh yeah, I guess debt is not a bad, but we've been told all our lives that debt's a bad thing, you know,
right.
Debt, you know, stuff like that. And the second thing is like, how much, like, what's the price tag on my time? And that's so important. I have a colleague who, I won't share his name to protect him, but, you know, he has the money, enough to basically use a lot of services to outsource a lot of his time. And so like he Ubers a lot, which is, you know, great. And because he's able to do work at the Uber while if he were driving, he's not able to do work, you know, respond to emails or stuff like that. Right. And so like, that made me, you know, I think I've been a very, a person that always very frugal, let's say. And so, but then I think about it, it's like, that's right. Like if this is going to like take me a couple of hours of my work and life, then, you know, maybe I'd rather not do it and pay something else to do it. And I think it's kind of hard for a person that like usually doesn't like spending money to like do that, you know? So I had to relearn about like, how much do I value my time?
I love that. How do you foster a healthy money mindset?
I think, well, A, I would say that like I have a healthy money mindset because of my parents. They grew up with not a lot and they now I think have a lot. And so that's a lot to them. I always try to think about future Sebastian. So maybe that's the mindset that I have. I think about what future Sebastian would like, would want, what kind of position would he like to be in, and how can I make his life easier. And then present Sebastian always appreciates past Sebastian about the decisions that I usually the decisions that I made. So,
okay, I'm adopting that too. And lastly, when was the last time you nabbed something and how did you do it?
Yeah, so I think two things, you know, come to mind. I'm recently planning a wedding. And so that's, you know, there's some challenges in planning a wedding too. Thank you. And there's also a challenge that I had to face, like as a student, or sorry, not as a student, as a professor with my students and so on. And I think I would say that the things that helped me to navigate those challenges are, one, planning. Again, thinking about future Sebastian and what the future Sebastian would like. And I think B, also listening a lot when it comes to a challenge, because, you know, it tends to be the case that I'm not the first person who's ever run into an issue like the one that I have before. And then there's some other people that have experiences on how to deal with those issues. And I think listening to and really internalizing that helps me a lot. Recently I was talking to a friend who's having some issues, and there's always like, one of my go-to advice is like this like Catholic prayer, which, you know, is part of my faith and whatever, which is the whole, you know, grant me serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is being such a, you know, repeated theme in my life. It's in the context now too, when we, you know, of everything that's happened in the world, of like, what are the things that you cannot change? Mm-hmm. What are the things that you should change if you have the courage? And which are the difference between those two? Those are things that I'd like.
Beautiful.
Keep my mind, keep me going.
That is beautiful. And what a beautiful note to end on. Sebastian, like I said, you've given us so much to contemplate. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I can't wait to get this episode out there and launch to all of our navigators. But in the meantime, stay well. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Hi.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Care to continue the convo? You can connect with fellow navigators in the app or on our Let's Nav It Facebook page. Oh, and be sure to get social with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Let's Nav It. That's LETSNAVIT. And finally, wherever you're listening to this podcast, it would really help us if you would take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. That's it for today's episode. Until next time,
let's nab it!